Whenever anybody brings up horoscopes, I just lose so much respect immediately. Just so much. Because it's like, where are you getting this from? Like, why do you think this is a thing? And then it all goes, well, because of gravity. And I'm like, but there's not any scientific basis for any of this whatsoever at all. It's just that you like reading things about yourself, even if they're fake. And then they'll get into like, well, there's different personality types. And I'm like, I don't disagree with you on that, but it's not based on when you're born. And then you start thinking about it in terms of the longer implication of like, so you think that people have personality types that they can't control, that they're just, we're going to prejudge them with based on when they're born during the year. Like that would be fucked up if we did that with race, but it's okay to do that with birth. Like, so you're taking something that's stupid and prejudicial. I think horoscopes are so dumb. So dumb.
I mean, but it's people trying to make sense of a confusing world, right? It's just, this is the way that they want to do it, by looking into a magic eye that is, you know, I think there is an art in writing horoscopes. There's an art in that, in doing that.
Yeah. No, hats off to the grifters that make money off that shit. Like, that's really impressive. But these people trying to make sense out of a chaotic world, are they from 1522? Because then I'm going to give them some credit. But if they're from now, the fuck is wrong with them?
I mean, look, we live in a world where people like eat all meat diets because they want to lionize the idea that we were better as cavemen. So there is always an element of us looking to a primal world that modernity has confused us. We need to return to an age of simple times.
What I like to do when anybody brings up a horoscope, they go, what are you? And I'll go, I'm a Sagittarius. And they go, I knew it. And we'll talk for a minute and I'll go, wait a minute, I was born in January. Am I Sagittarius? And they go, oh no, you're a Capricorn. Yeah, but that makes sense too, though. And it's like, yeah, because whatever I said, you were going to say that I was that thing. Yeah. And then you're going to go, well, okay, so some people present as this one thing, but they're actually a different thing. And I'm like, right, because it's bullshit. Because it's like, if you just want to make a personality chart and then say some people act this, like, that's fine. Like, Briggs-Myers is a way of looking at things, but claiming that there's like magical tides that are emanating from Jupiter because it's lined up with Venus is just, ugh. Anyway, how are you two?
You are way more fired up on this time zone than you were at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Well, it's like 5 o'clock my time, so I'm fully awake now.
You are ready to roll.
Yeah,
I feel like that is the ideal time to record because you've been able to have your brain on for a while, where this 10 a.m. thing for me, like, I'm barely alive. So I like your time zone better.
I don't know, man. I'm ready to stop working.
Wake up at 5 a.m. though, you nut.
Yeah.
So you've had a whole day. We don't do that. You're
such an Aquarius.
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young. From Edinburgh, Scotland,
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And from Mexico City, Mexico,
I am Jennifer Briney.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We are going to discuss Ukraine being upset about their pathway to NATO membership, along with Chuck Schumer facing his greatest opponent yet, Logan Paul, along with your emails here on the program. Heaton, you are now European bound. You are now bound to the European continent. You are there in the UK. Have you gotten into any fun UK-centric hijinks just yet?
I had salmon pancakes with my friends Dickie and Stone about 3 hours ago. Does that qualify?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Salmon pancakes. Wait, so is that salmon in a regular pancake or is it just very flat salmon?
While I love the idea that Scots get out a rolling pin to flatten their salmon because they just can't bear puffy salmon, there's a place I like called Stacks and Still, which is sort of like a really fancy Scottish IHOP. So everything is served to you on pancakes. And normally I order a Scottish breakfast on a pancake, but I also am trying not to eat pork or chicken. And so I went salmon, which honestly, not that good on a pancake. That was kind of a misstep.
I was going to say, if I were to roll the dice, in the culinary department, Scotland is not the first country that I would think to do it in, let alone with the delicate fusion of fish and pancakes.
Well, you have to understand that Scottish cuisine is all predicated on how do we not die during winter? That's the whole, yeah. All of it boils down to, we have like black pudding is just like, as I understand it, it's just like cow blood with oats that have been cooked up. Because there was some point in history where like, that's all they got. We got oats. We got that fat cow out back. We can't eat the cow or we'll die, but we can bleed it a little. And so that, like, therein lies kind of, I think, the essence of British cuisine.
I think you could have probably stopped with the thing about Scottish cuisine is it all boils down. That's pretty much it, right? It's just let's boil anything we possibly can until some kind of congealed product is yielded, and we will pretend that it's good because the grossness makes us stronger.
That said, full Scottish breakfast is wonderful. We don't do this in America. This is one of the things. America does a lot of things really, really well. Breakfast, however, and I know everybody thinks American breakfast is good, but let me ask you this. How often have you had baked beans with your breakfast when not camping? Probably never. That's a regular staple of the Scottish and English diet is baked beans and hash browns and sausage. This bucket of fried pork and beans, because modern Scottish cuisine has moved on from how do we not starve to death the winter to how do we soak up this hangover? And that was a really good hump to cross in the last few years.
Yeah. So you're into the beans.
Oh, I love the beans. Yeah.
And they also do the tomato, right? Like they do like a full stewed tomato.
I don't really like the tomato. I think it looks weird. They fry it up and it's, I don't know. I could take or leave that. But I like the beans, though.
Too squishy?
It looks gross. They cook a little bit, so the skin is kind of puckered.
Yeah.
But it's still kind of hard on the inside. And I always just kind of want to be like, thank you so much, but could you just give me something that doesn't look like an animal, like died in embryonic form on my plate? I'll just take like more beans or a scone or something.
There was a dish here yesterday at the buffet where they had cherry tomatoes that were cooked in it. And I love tomatoes, so I took them. But Joe got a real kick out of the fact that it's very hard to get a cherry tomato that's been cooked onto your fork.
Yeah.
Like, if you try and stab it, it just flies away. And then it's kind of slimy, and so you can't balance it on the fork. And so I just like couldn't get these tomatoes to my mouth without them rolling all over the table. It's really a...
It is definitely a problem for any kind of cherry tomato, especially like in salad too. If you like try to get a uncooked cherry tomato coated in oil on a fork, it's fucking impossible. No one's been able to do it for 50 years.
Yeah, the oil thing. But they're hard enough to where I feel like you can stab them if they're not cooked.
Yeah, but you gotta go like one of those island fisher people that don't use hooks or rods. Like you gotta get that right at the exact point of tension.
Jen, what I find funny about your culinary conundrum is in the animal world, making animals work for food is considered mental enrichment activities. So like I've volunteered at a couple of elephant sanctuaries, and we would hide the bananas and things. Banana leaves. We'd hide it. We'd like make structures. We'd hide them around, make them hunt for it. And I was, for one day, I was a bear keeper in Cambodia, and same thing, had to hide bear food. And when I got Wallace, who you've met, he was really, really, really energetic when I first got him. And I mentioned it to the shelter that I wasn't sure how to deal with the energy. And they went, well, here's an idea. You could, instead of putting his food in a bowl, throw it in the yard, and he'll have to walk around and smell for it. And I did that. And for a week, I would fling it in the yard. And then Wallace would look at me like, the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Why are you, what the, and then he would go out and he'd just stand in the middle of it like an idiot. And then I would walk out in a bathrobe and point to individual kibbles. And my neighbors would come out and go, there's that guy again that walks into his yard and points all the individual kibbles to his dog like a weirdo.
Poor Wallace.
This is the kind of suburban bizarre tableau that we lose when we cluster in the cities. Right? This is the kind of charm that suburbia gives America. Let's talk about NATO, huh? The North Atlantic Treaty Organization's annual summit in Poland this week has been chock full of news. Sweden is now all but certain to end its long history of neutrality after Turkey announced that they would back the membership. Finland is also now cleared to join. But one country that does not have a timetable for membership is the one most talked about, and the reason that Sweden and Finland applied to join in the first place, Ukraine, which, in case you're wondering, is still under attack from Russia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky posted his feelings about the current state of his country's membership on Twitter. Quote, "We value our allies. We value our shared security. We also appreciate an open conversation. Ukraine will be represented at the NATO summit in Vilnius because it is all about respect. But Ukraine also deserves respect. Now, on the way, we receive signals that certain wording is being discussed without Ukraine. And I would like to emphasize that this wording is about the invitation to become NATO member, not about Ukraine's membership. It is unprecedented and absurd when time frame is not set neither for the invitation nor for Ukraine's membership, while at the same time vague wording about quote unquote conditions is added even for inviting Ukraine. It seems that there's no readiness either to invite Ukraine to NATO nor to make them a member of the alliance. This means that the window of opportunity is being left to bargain Ukraine's membership in NATO in negotiations with Russia. And for Russia, this means motivation to continue its terror. Uncertainty is weakness, and I will openly discuss this at the summit," end quote. I'm unsure if he also published it to Threads. Ukraine's possible NATO membership is part of Russia's justification for invading Ukraine. Putin's rhetoric has centered on America's meddling, including putting NATO countries on Russia's border, Ukraine chief among them. Of course, all of this hinges on Article 5 of NATO, which essentially states that any attack on a member is an attack on all members, and other member countries are obligated to assist the country under attack. The nature of assistance isn't strictly defined, but may include military support. The only time that Article 5, of course, has been invoked was after September 11th by the U.S. of A. Jen, you have been on the Ukraine beat for a while. Should they be steamed that there is no pathway to membership to NATO, as Zelensky tweeted?
So you have to put yourself in a Ukrainian's shoes right now, right?
Yes.
Ukraine has been assimilated essentially with NATO since 2014. They've done exercises with us. To have them be now in this war for a year and a half and still not be told that you're ever going to be an official part of NATO, you can understand their feelings about it. But you can also understand that inviting Ukraine into NATO or even putting it in a timetable right now is an incredibly stupid idea. And I'm very happy that cooler heads have prevailed here. Surprisingly, Joe Biden being one of them, because NATO membership was one of the things that has been listed over and over again by Vladimir Putin as one of his motivations for the war. He said that Ukraine, you know, in the 1990s, we promised Russia that we wouldn't be expanding NATO right up to their border. And that's precisely what we did. And it was always a red line for them, for Ukraine. There's WikiLeaks cables that go back to 2008, where they said, you know, that is just never going to be acceptable to us. And so if you look at what's happening now, the negotiations with Russia haven't started, but we're back at a stalemate that looks a lot like what we've been dealing with since the civil war started in 2014. We all seem to think that this war started last year. It started in 2014, and it's always been about this Eastern Russian section, which Russia has taken more territory now, and Crimea. And at some point, there's going to have to be negotiations on what the new borders are, because there's this offensive that's going on in Ukraine. It's apparently not going well. They're not taking back all that much territory. There's a snowball's chance in hell that they're ever getting Crimea.
The Ukrainians are not taking back that much territory.
Yeah. They're just, okay, they're, yes. We're going to a stalemate.
A counteroffensive to what the Russians have done up until
yes,
now.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, I should say counteroffensive. Yeah. But, and the Russians are still fighting. But, you know, one of the reasons that we're now sending cluster munitions, which is a whole other topic and awful, but one of the reasons why we're doing that is because Ukraine is running out of ammunition, and they're straight up saying it. So yes, we're coming to a stalemate situation here. There's going to have to be negotiations, and there is no way that NATO membership for Ukraine is not going to be a bargaining chip. So to take that off the table now, that would just be very, very unwise for the NATO countries to do. So, and then there's also the factor that there are some qualifications that NATO has to have a new country enter. And there's really five of them. And By my calculations, Ukraine only meets three. So one of them is they have to be compatible with NATO forces. They clearly are. They have to have civilian control of the military. Zelensky's a comedian. He's not a general. So they check that one off. They have to be a market economy, which is really why this all started. In 2014, there was a trade agreement that the old president was refusing to sign with the EU at the very last minute, decided to partner instead with Russia. And that's why we regime changed him. So they are a market economy. There are companies lining up for the reconstruction contract. So they check that box. But there's one that says they have to respect borders with their neighbors. And this Crimea thing is going to be an issue. So if, as long as these borders are not decided upon, that they do not qualify for NATO membership. And then the number one thing they have to be is a democracy. And I'm sorry, but right now, Ukraine is not a democracy. Zelensky has banned opposition parties from running in elections. The media has been consolidated and is now pretty much entirely in state control. And it's been announced that the parliamentary elections that were scheduled for October of this year and the presidential election scheduled for next year have been canceled. And, you know, you'll hear a lot of people say that it's because of Ukraine's constitution, which, like, by the way, if that's in your constitution, you're not a democracy. But the constitution says if you're under martial law, you can't have an election. But here in the United States, we've had elections during World War I, World War II, post 9/11, our own civil war. We had elections during COVID, which were all kinds of crazy, but we are advising Ukraine on everything. If they wanted to make elections happen to prove that they're a democracy, I think there are pathways to make that happen. But canceling the elections, you can't call yourself a democracy if you do that. And if you look at like what's happening with the people of Ukraine, in the beginning of the war, everyone was volunteering to fight. Now they're conscripting people. Is that the word? I just said it wrong.
Conscripting.
People. Thank you. Yeah. It's basically a draft. They're forcing people to fight, which lets you know that there are people in this country that don't particularly love the way the war is going, and they have no avenue via voting to replace Zelensky if they want to. So with that being the number one qualification for NATO membership, even promising them a timetable without them actually being a democracy, it's just a hard no. And so I think it's probably good that NATO is saying like, no, Ukraine, you don't make some of the most basic qualifications and you need to do that before we'll even consider it. So yeah, Zelensky can be upset about it, but if he's canceling elections, that's just too bad.
Heaton, have you followed this cluster bomb, cluster munition controversy?
I have not. I saw a headline that the Biden administration is giving them cluster bombs, but they're worried about potential civilian casualties from it. I am not surprised.
In that specific order, they have been very worried about civilian casualties. They are now giving what their former press secretary Jen Psaki has called a war crime device to Ukraine. And I initially thought that they were trying to say the cluster munitions and cluster bombs were using very specifically cluster munitions and not cluster bombs. And I thought it was a PR thing. But as it turns out, a bomb very specifically is a thing that's dropped from the air. So if you launch it as a missile, it's a cluster munition. So they're just preserving their options. Anyway, now you're caught up.
Thank you very much. I am not terribly surprised by that. I did not know that there was a war crimes capacity to it. But at this point, I think it's whether we're doing it for good reasons or bad reasons or other, it is a proxy war that the United States is funding. So I'm not surprised that we would be sending over munitions, particularly as the war drags on, that we would be upping the game. And as they start to run out of munitions, that we would be upping the game as well. But I do want to real quick just bring up, I find it odd that anybody would be positing NATO should include Ukraine at this moment, or that we should be fast-tracking Ukraine, because the second they become a NATO member, that means anybody shooting them is shooting us. So if they joined NATO and then Russia continued prosecuting the war, we would go to World War III. We would have a shooting war with Russia. That is how that would work. So right now, where they're actively involved in war, and I hope that the war stops, and I would love for Ukraine to get full sovereignty and territorial autonomy and get the land back. That would be a positive outcome. But at the moment, to be angry that we're not admitting them to NATO is the same thing as saying the United States should threaten atomic warfare over this conflict. If Ukraine joins NATO and it's during the war, that is the case. So that's basically what they're advocating for is America should threaten atomic warfare with Russia unless Russia leaves. And that's a level of brinksmanship I'm not ready to do. And then in terms of a timeline, I'm not really sure what that timeline would look like anyway. Would it, if you said the moment the war concludes, then we will begin admitting Ukraine to NATO, it would seem to me that that would potentially prolong the conflict because it would give Russia an incentive to drag it out. Fun fact for you. You guys know about Andorra? Have you heard of Andorra?
Mm-mm. Is that Bewitched, Mom?
That's right. My favorite was Uncle Arthur. He was the funniest, in my opinion. Andorra's this tiny little postage stamp of a country.
This is going to be my new lane. Jokes for 70-year-olds.
Andorra's this little postage stamp of a country in the Pyrenees between Spain and France. Very small. There's one city, Andorra La Vella. Historically, their heads of state are the head of France and Spain simultaneously. Basically, imagine like a mid-sized town that is somehow independent but kind of sharing France and Spain. World War I, Andorra goes to war with Germany because France and Spain are at war with its two allies there. They go off. They don't complete the war. They come home because they got a farm. They just come home. There's harvest time. They don't conclude the war. They're not there at the Treaty of Vienna because they've already gone home. They sit out of World War II entirely, don't participate in it. In the 50s, the mayor of Andorra La Vella was going through their books, and he was looking at it and went, do we not ever declare peace with Germany from World War I? And then they realized that World War I was still active as a legal conflict into the 1950s, that if Germany had wanted to go in to Andorra, it would have been totally legal. So they called up the Chancellor of West Germany rather sheepishly and went, hi, it's Andorra. We accept your surrender from World War I, and we are now declaring peace. I bring up that, I think, delightful anecdote to illustrate the fact that you could keep a legal conflict going. Like, we're still technically at war with North Korea. South Korea and North Korea are at war. They just have a state of truce. And so depending on how you want to slice it, I would think that that could potentially give Vladimir Putin a reason to drag it out. And he, from his perspective, he might just pay a Ukraine doesn't join NATO tax of X million dollars per year or X lives lost per year. So having a very clear timetable, I don't think would be a suitable thing to do.
So I think that's the argument from the Ukrainian side, is that we're already here. So to not put what they view as, or at least this regime sees as, the eventual conclusion of all this, and God knows what's been promised behind the scenes, that we're already at the point where Russia's invaded. Russia believes this is already going to happen. They've already invaded. Why are we going to blink now while the hard part has already started? Why are we going to do all the painful stuff and then not get what should be the rightful, from their perspective, conclusion, right, that we have protection and Ukraine is now on the path to be a more prosperous country because we won't just be fodder between these two gigantic machines. We will be a part of one of the machines. And go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I'm going to invite some hate mail for this. I think it's rather debatable whether Ukraine acceding to NATO would actually be safer for Ukraine in the long run. And the reason that I bring that up is, first of all, let's distinguish between moral culpability and prudence when we're talking about Russia. Vladimir Putin has a lot of blood on his hands. I don't think he's a good guy. I don't think that Ukraine and Russia are equal moral arbiters within this conflict. I think Russia's the baddie. That said, there's a difference between the moral culpability that Vladimir Putin deserves versus just the prudence of a situation which we can either ameliorate or inflame. And having a defensive anti-Russian alliance on the border of Russia, I think, would set a permanent fault line that would keep us at a kind of DEFCON 2 level for Ukraine. I don't know that it would make them. Like, Ukraine is an independent sovereign country, and they should make their own decisions, and I am not saying otherwise. But in terms of NATO, which we are a member of, and in terms of the United States funding, I would, if I were looking to make a deal at this point, what I would do is say Ukraine joins the EU. Ukraine gets to join the European Union. It gets the cultural, civic, and economic benefits of being in the EU, which I think would be substantive and phenomenal for Ukraine as it rebuilds, but it stays out of NATO. And the reason I say that is that I think if Russia and the United States and NATO, in terms of our military commitments, made that a neutral area in regards to our own conflict, I think that that would be safer for Ukraine. And Ukraine could form an alliance with some of the other groups there. The European Union is not the same thing as NATO. It has battle groups where France and Turkey and Sweden will be in a battle group, or Spain and, you know, you get the impression, right? So I'm not convinced that this would be safer for Ukraine. I think that that would just kind of keep us a permanent DEFCON 2.
To counter to your point, though, there's a reason why Sweden and Finland are joining. And it's not because they feel they'll be in more peril because they're joining NATO. It's because they feel that NATO will create a suitable element of a deterrent for Russia to do anything that would put them in military peril. And to Jen's point, as she has very consistently said from the very before this whole Ukraine conflict, the point of at least the Biden and Obama State Department has been break the back of the Putin regime. And if that's the goal, then I think you're right. I don't think Vladimir Putin would ever allow Ukraine to join NATO, and at least putting a invitation timetable publicly out there would be an invitation to bring this to a conclusion that ends with Vladimir Putin out of control of Russia, and a person that comes in there that is at least amiable to the idea of negotiation with Ukraine being a part of NATO. And if that has been the stated goal, or at least the unstated but loudly implied goal of the American powers that be in the State Department when Democrats are president, then that would seem to be a way to escalate it to that point. It is an accelerationist philosophy. And I agree with Jen that it is kind of a surprise that we have not gotten, you know, America hiking up its skirt just a little bit to hint that this is more of a reality than it might be. But I can see the point if you understand the goals.
I totally get where Ukraine is coming from. And if I were getting bombed and America had made promises to me, was funding the war, and was the historic nemesis of Russia, why I would absolutely want to ally. I totally get it. But from where I'm looking at, once again, stating I don't think Vladimir Putin is a good guy, or that America is morally culpable for this, or that Ukraine is morally culpable for this. From where I'm looking at, the instigating factors tend to be NATO encroachment. Why did Russia take Crimea? It already had a naval base there. Like they've wanted a warm water port there for 600 years. So it's a really important strategic element for Russia. They already had a naval base there. Why? Because Ukraine was beginning to pivot towards the West, and they were saying that they were going to potentially take away the lease on the naval base. So Ukraine got invaded by Russia to make sure that they solidified that permanent naval base there. The invasion in Georgia happened a month.
Apparently, it's also a very popular vacation destination for Russians.
It's probably lovely, or was. Georgia got invaded shortly after George W. Bush made his comments that Georgia and Ukraine were going to join the United States. I mean, it happened right after that. The latest round, I think, has kind of largely followed suit. I think this could have been diffused if 2 years ago, America or Ukraine had said, we're going to come up with some system that doesn't involve Ukraine joining NATO. And again, my preference would have been for Ukraine to join the European Union and to have Ukraine do whatever it wants militarily because it's a sovereign country, but for Russia and the United States to agree that we would be neutral towards Ukraine in order to not drag them into any of our shit.
Jen?
I mean, yeah, I don't really have anything else to say about it. Like, they just shouldn't be a part of NATO. Like, when you look at this from the Ukrainian perspective, I mean, Andrew, you're right that this is a proxy war. We don't want World War III, but Ukraine is already in that war. They're already in a literally existential war. Their buildings, their apartment buildings, their civilians are being killed. So they do want the United States military to show up with humans and guns blazing. Like, they want the invasion. We were not invited into Iraq. We were not invited into Libya or Afghanistan. We were never invited into Syria, which, by the way, we're still in and we're still bombing. We haven't been invited to do any of these things, but they want us in Ukraine. And so by begging to be a part of NATO as fast as possible, they want World War III because they're already in it. And so they just want the power of all the militaries of the neighbors and the United States on their side. You can completely understand it. And up until this point, we've really said like we're going to do whatever the Ukrainians want us to do. And this is really the first time I've seen Joe Biden in a real way say like, nah, hold up a little bit. And I think this is instructive going back to 2008, because George W. Bush made promises to Georgia and Ukraine about NATO membership that he had no business making. He made promises that he had no power to make. And I think it's wise for Joe Biden not to do the same thing. So, and I feel bad for the Ukrainians. I've always felt bad for the Ukrainians, but this goes back a while, you know, like this is fundamentally a border dispute. But yeah, this NATO membership thing, it's always been key for Russia. It has to remain a chip on the table if negotiations are ever going to end this war. That's really the bottom line.
And that's the biggest thing that Vladimir Zelensky even said in that tweet is that if you are not taking it off the table, then when the negotiations happen, we know that's going to be a part of it. And that's something that they are not pleased with. They would like it to not be a part of that. Yeah.
Too bad.
Hey, Justin.
Yes.
Do you think Ukraine should join NATO? Do you think it would be a good idea?
No, I don't. I don't personally think that. Not because I mean, here's what I don't know. I don't know what promises have been made to them throughout the years. And obviously they've had a very fractured political history. But so it's always a thing with American foreign policy. Whenever I want to get swayed into something that is probably more, adventurous in terms of foreign or military policy than I would personally hold, usually the argument that gets me there is, well, we have made promises. We have made commitments to various different secretarian elements of this country that it would be bad for American moral leadership if we did not back up what we said. So again, without knowing what has been told to Ukraine throughout the years, what has been told to Ukraine throughout this conflict, I am operating with incomplete data from a conceptual level. No, I don't think putting Article 5 level consequences on a border that has been constantly pushed back and forth over the last 15 years is a good thing. I think that that is a really, really, really fast way to start World War III.
And especially, I think we also need to put a lot of focus on Crimea, because we're looking at the borders where the fighting has been in actual Ukraine. But it is United States law. I've seen it with my own eyes. That this conflict is not over, according to the United States, until Crimea is Ukrainian territory once again. That is still the home of the Black Sea Fleet for the Russians. They're not going to give it up without possibly going nuclear. I mean, it means so much to them. It's why they took it in 2014. And also, by the way, Crimea, when my parents were born — my parents aren't that old — when my parents were born, it was Russian.
Yes.
So like the fact that it was even Ukrainian territory was kind of a deal with the Ukrainian government. A lot of people there speak Russian. They feel like they're Russian. There hasn't been a lot of bloodshed at all in Crimea. It's been a different situation. And so until that, I mean, no one is talking about Crimea policy. No one is saying like, okay, Russia, you can have it. Like Zelensky is saying that he wants to take our weapons and use them to get Crimea back, which is a huge escalation of this war. And so until that becomes somewhat settled, until we agree on what we're doing with Ukraine, with Crimea, which in my opinion should be, it's Russian. It's been Russian since 2014. Just put that chip on the table and give that one away. But Zelensky is refusing to do that. And so we have the war as it is now. If that remains a goal, we have escalations coming that I know I'm not willing to send my friends — well, I mean, I'm old now, so my friends' kids — to die for.
I would do a USO tour under those circumstances, Jen. I'm up for a USO tour as a comedian. If the military ever wants me, I won't talk about strategy. I'll do horse jokes. It'll be delightful. So I could be imperiled theoretically.
Yeah. But I just feel like there's the situation that we're looking at borders, but Crimea is a big part of this. And so I just think there needs to be some focus on that and an understanding that this war can actually escalate in very extreme ways if that is an actual goal that is shared by NATO countries. Like Zelensky has been very clear that he wants Crimea, but if this is shared by NATO countries and we're willing to have this war go on that long, this war is only just beginning.
Well, yeah. And that gets back to the State Department goal of breaking Putin's back, right? Is that I think that they would like it to go in the following order. Putin falls. Then we can start negotiations. Then we can figure out what the negotiations are and make things right on the Ukrainian side. And then depending on where all that lands, then we can start to maybe think about talking about or deny outright the NATO question. But right now, the NATO thing is hanging over all of it because it is a deterrent element for Russia or an accelerationist element to get Putin out of there and to bring this war to a boil, which, as we've pointed out on this show, has been kind of the point. They've wanted this conflict. This State Department has wanted this conflict for a while. There's a reason why we went in so fast and so hard with our support, is because they've been planning for it, if not seeding the ground for it for you know, over a decade now.
Since 2014.
We're alternately, it's not accelerationist. It's a sore that won't heal that bleeds Russia out. I've spoken to people that, like, they're like, hey, the amount of money we're putting into this compared to the amount of money and blood the Russians are spilling is great. Like I think there are people that view this as a really good deal to weaken Russia, in which case, yes. I don't know that there is a big incentive for us to make this go away or accelerate, like just have it limp along and make Russia weaker and weaker as long as we can.
Well, and I think, you know, we have a pretty nasty government funding season coming up. And there are people in the United States Congress that are going to be asking these questions, that are going to say once and for all, what is the goal here? Is it to regime change Russia? Is it to get all of the Ukrainian territory back, including Crimea, as is according to United States law? Or is it to get the territory that Russia has taken since February? Like, what is it? Like, we don't know what it is. And I think that's a question that's going to be asked and will have to be answered sometime soon, or at least I hope so, because this has been a long time without really understanding what is being fought for. Like, what are we aiming for?
And I think politically, you are right in that the war coalition is beginning to fray. The you know, in the House, it's been gone for a little bit. The Republicans have been very critical about the war in Ukraine. Stuff like this cluster bomb stuff has begun to really, really stir opposition to the war on the left, specifically the progressive left, which were never.
Yeah, because by the way, those weapons are banned in 120 countries. Mm-hmm. Like, these are war crimes. Like, that's, and there's now a bipartisan coalition. It's not just the progressives. Matt Gaetz has signed on to an amendment to the NDAA. They're actually going to be voting on it in the next couple of days to stop those transfers. So it's like there's coalitions building to finally push back on some of what the Biden administration has wanted to do. Because in Congress so far, it's just been blank check after blank check. Yes. And this is the first time that I've seen a real effort to say, like, hold up, this is a bad idea. Because with cluster munitions, if people aren't aware of them, they drop a whole bunch of little bombs. And what happens, like in Laos, we dropped a ton of these on Laos. And 50 years later, children will just be out in a field and they'll see something that looks like a ball and they'll pick it up and it explodes and they die. And so that's what we are sending to Ukraine. That's why people are so upset about it. And Congress, they're not just going to allow it this time. Maybe we'll see what happens with the amendment. But like, I'm seeing pushback for the first time.
Oh, shit. So that's what we're talking about. Like when I went to Cambodia here a couple of years ago, where I was a bear keeper for a day, I also went. There was a local group that shows they do displays where dogs look for unexploded bombs. Yep. They've got these German shepherds. Two of them came out. One of them immediately started humping the other one, but that one getting humped did its job. It wandered around looking for those while the other dog was actively humping it. I was very impressed with the stick-to-itiveness and work ethic of that dog that was getting humped. But you're absolutely right, Jen. The United States dropped more bombs on Cambodia than it did on Europe during World War II. We dropped a ton of, but we don't, it just doesn't come up because it's not a big thing in our world, but it's a big thing over there. There's a ton of unexploded bombs laying around Cambodia, Laos. I didn't realize that's what we're talking about. We're talking about that. So that's one of the concerns here, is that they're I don't know if people know, bombs don't tend to expire very quickly. Fun fact, my grandfather, when I was growing up, he had as a doorstop this big ass munition shell, like a big shell, like maybe knee high. And I was like, where did you get that? Did you get it from an army surplus store? And he's like, oh no, you know, the shed we got out back, we bought that from the army and it was in the shed. And I was like, so you're just using a live munition shell as the doorstop that you bang your door into? And he went, I soaked it in a bucket for a few days. It's fine. And so fortunately for the Heaton family, it was. But I assume that's one of the big concerns we've got is the long-term implications of this is that there'll be parts of Ukraine that are basically uninhabitable from this. And then is that where the civilian casualties is coming from? Or is it the spread is so large that it just tends to hurt civilian populations as well? Because I don't know
the issue is the unexploded nature of it, and especially if you're using it in civilian areas. The argument from the Ukrainian perspective is that Russia's already using these on them right now. So it's like, it's not like this will be introducing the concept of cluster bombs into this war. And their argument is that we're going to not drop it on civilian areas. We're going to drop it in places where they should be dropped. And we're already getting pummeled with this and our children are going to be dealing with it forever anyway. So we should deserve to have it. But still, the United States has taken a pretty strident line about the lack of use on this. And again, it was only one press secretary ago where we were bemoaning the use of this by Russia and saying that they were culpable for war crimes. And now we are sending our own weapons over there for the Ukrainian usage.
But you see, our bombs are good. See?
Yeah. Well, I mean, but maybe not. And that's, you know, there's a lot of fight that is going to be happening in a very, very short amount of time with Congress over the next few weeks before they go on vacation again and then come back and work for a few weeks before going on vacation. But one of the biggest elements of it is the Defense Authorization Act. And there's a lot of fight. And I do agree with you, Jen. I think that there is a cross-party hesitation, specifically in the House. We'll find out whether or not it's in the Senate, because the Senate, the military element of the Senate is very, very strong, especially with the Democratic president in charge and a Democratic majority. But in the House, we will find out exactly what happens there as they get back to work pretty soon. Hey, patreon.com/we're not wrong. This is the week, friends, that we're going to hit 900. In fact, I'm going to look right now here. I'm going to do a little thing I like to call wasted time on the podcast so I can search for what our Patreon number is currently. Nine people is all we need. We have 891 members of people who are getting a bonus topic each and every week on this program. Please, friends, less than 10 of you. Break the 900 barrier. This week, your bonus topic will be about chemical weapons. So we're going from a discussion about cluster bombs and unexploded munitions for children to pick up to the scourge of World War I, the chapter finally closed. All's quiet on the Western Front after we have destroyed America's stockpile of chemical weapons. We will discuss that on our Patreon exclusive bonus episode. But let's talk about Chuck Schumer, huh? Senate Majority Leader Schumer is urging the Food and Drug Administration to investigate Prime, a sports energy drink popular among the youth and created by social media influencers Logan Paul and KSI. The drink, which contains 200 milligrams of caffeine per 12 ounces, far surpassing the caffeine content in a can of Coca-Cola or Red Bull, has gained a wide following since its 2022 launch, becoming an official partner of FC Barcelona and going viral on platforms like TikTok. Schumer's call for investigation stems from the drink's marketing tactics, claims, and high caffeine content, and follows serious concerns voiced by physicians about the potential health impacts on children and teenagers. Schumer's request is also bolstered by international actions against Prime, with countries like Australia, South Africa, the UK, Canada, and New Zealand banning the drink in schools. The Senate Majority Leader is urging the FDA to probe the lack of sufficient warnings about its content and the company's targeted advertising toward these kids. Despite concerns, a representative with Prime Energy stated that the drink's caffeine content is comparable to other top-selling energy drinks and within legal limits of the countries in which it's sold. They've also asserted that Prime Energy has complied with FDA guidelines before hitting the market, emphasizing that its packaging and marketing materials clearly state that it is not intended for anyone under the age of 18. Heaton, you wanted to talk about this. So are you resting easy now that Chuck Schumer is looking out for the youth of America?
I constantly rest easy knowing that Chuck Schumer's on the job, that he's, as I'm going to sleep, he is sitting in his office going, should we regulate standardized ladder widths? Should we regulate hot sauce hotness? Because he's always looking out for us, because Chuck Schumer believes deep down that he is your dad. I think Chuck Schumer is a paragon of both government paternalism and, on top of that, unnecessary freak out. So I kind of became politically aware of Chuck Schumer back during the Palcohol scare. Do either of you recall Palcohol?
No.
Palcohol was a camping product that got trotted out 2012 or so. The idea was that if you're hiking, you don't want to carry bottles of beer with you or bottles of liquor or whatever, but you might want to have a drink at the end of the day. So they made this product called Palcohol, which was powdered alcohol. And you could put it in your backpack. And then later at the campfire, you could mix it in with cider and have a hard cider or something like that. And Chuck Schumer freaked out because he was like, what if people snort it? If people snorted it, they'd get drunk. What if people put it in other people's drinks to get them drunker? And all of these different things. And I looked into it, and it was just prima facie stupidity. It cost a lot more to buy Palcohol than it does to buy just a bottle of alcohol. The only place it was going to work would be if you were climbing up a mountain and you didn't want to have a bottle in your backpack. Like if you just wanted to get drunk, you would just go buy booze. People can put booze in your drink right now at the bar. It's illegal and reprehensible, but they could theoretically do it. So it's not like Palcohol, which would sit there and you'd have to stir in and stuff, was going to be an easier way to do that. And then the snorting thing was absolutely ridiculous. In order to snort enough Palcohol to get drunk, you basically have to put like a 1-inch line on a 1-inch thick line across an entire table and snort the whole thing. I'm told that it's like snorting baking soda, only less pleasant. So it wasn't going to happen. But that's, bet. He has a mindset of,
Andrew, you should do it for science.
I should do it for science. You know what? Maybe, you know, finally I feel more inclined to do cocaine. I've never done there cocaine before, but I think I would do that before Palcohol based on what I've heard. My point is that Schumer is beginning with a premise of, if something could theoretically be scary, I want to look at it and roll around in it and test it on behalf of the voters who are kind of dumb. And then once I feel comfortable, I may give permission to people to do that. And I think it's predicated on bad governance. I want the government to protect people from bears, communists, burglars. And I also want the government to protect people from poverty and things like that. Like I'm a social democrat. I think the government should protect you from a lot of these, but I don't think the government should protect you from yourself. And that's something that Chuck Schumer has consistently promoted throughout his career, is the idea that the government exists in part to protect you from your own bad decisions. And I think that that has no place within a free society. If you can't trust people to make decisions about caffeine, I have no idea how you think you could trust people to make decisions about voting. The only place that I'm going to give him some credit here is if they wanted to ban it in schools, that makes sense to me because it could affect teenagers. But even there too, like the idea that this is some crazy amount of caffeine, which is how this is being spread around. It's crazy. 200 milligrams. 200 milligrams is a medium cup of coffee at Dunkin' Donuts. Medium cup of coffee at Dunkin' Donuts is 200 milligrams. A large coffee at Starbucks is like 300 milligrams. And so this is not with out of the ordinary level caffeines for just regular coffee drinks. And I think it's an unnecessary freak out. If the FDA wanted to like say, hey, you got to make the not for kids label bigger, I think that that would be legitimate. If they wanted to like try and restrict where it's sold in terms of kids at schools, that's okay. But I think that this is more than that, just evidence of him freaking out about something he doesn't need to freak out about based on this idea that the government should be your dad.
But what is he actually suggesting? Is he saying that it should be banned? Like what, when you say he's being our dad, like what is dad trying to do?
He is urging the FDA to investigate it.
So that's not who cares? Like, I don't see the big deal here.
I mean, I think
I wanted to talk about the issue broadly because I thought it was an interesting intersection with just the idea of government paternalism. And I think it's a worthwhile topic insofar as that goes. But I think one of the other things that happens with Chuck Schumer and other people is that they may not like a product and they want it to go away. And so they'll kind of threaten it with some sort of retaliatory action through the FDA or something like that. So it's not as if merely investigating it will have no effect on it. And given his track record on everything else, I don't think he would stop there.
Heaton, I would like to take this moment to point out your faith in Chuck Schumer, that you truly believe that he is here to create some kind of governmental response to what he genuinely views as a problem. Because I don't believe that's what's happening here. I believe that what we are seeing with this is a very well-documented and recorded track record of the biggest publicity slut in Washington yet again opening his legs so cameras will show up and pay attention to the goods that he has in store. The things that Chuck Schumer has pointed out, I didn't even know Palkahol. The first time that I came across Chuck Schumer was when he first started trying to regulate the Fong Hua buses in New York City. You remember those?
I remember those.
The Chinatown buses. Heaton, was that in your New York era?
I took the Chinatown bus once, and I recall liking it.
Yes, it would just like break down. Like you could end up sitting next to an actual chicken. Like they were weird buses.
Yeah. So basically, if you've never been in the New York or Boston or DC area, there were these Chinatown bus lines for which would be extraordinarily cheap, cheaper than Greyhound, cheaper than everything. They'd pick you up on the street, especially in the early days of it. I think they've regulated them a little bit where now they make them pull into some bus station or whatever. But initially it was lawless. Like you would be like, all right, I'm going to go to Boston for $15. It's going to take anywhere between the normal 4 or 5 hours that it takes and 8, because you have no idea where they're going to stop or how it's going to break down. And also, there's 3 or 4 bus lines and they are all ruthlessly competing with each other. Like, you know, like sometimes you order like Indian spicy at an Indian restaurant and then there's like American spicy. There is regular competition and then there's Chinese competition and they would just out and out lie to you. They'd say that your ticket like wasn't good for where you were standing. They'd try to sell you another ticket. Then they'd start arguing in Mandarin and scream at each other. It was a scene. Now, did that need to be regulated on some level? For a very, very broke 20-something who wanted to get to Boston for $15, I was greatly appreciative of this bargain that was offered to me, but I could see the argument. It didn't matter. Chuck Schumer was there to hold a press conference in front of a thing that would get him a lot of attention. I once knew a girl, no BS, that worked in Chuck Schumer's office or one of the satellite offices in New York State, and her job was to get every single newspaper that she could and cut out every time that Chuck Schumer's name was mentioned, count that up, and this is when Hillary Clinton was the other senator from New York, also cut out every time Hillary Clinton's name was mentioned and file a daily report of how his name mentions were stacked up against her name mentions. So what we are seeing here is nothing short of yet another example of SEO Schumer looking at what people are talking about, what's trending, the fact that Logan Paul is a big name, that KSI is a big name, that Prime is a new product that is getting a lot of attention, and holding a press conference about it. Because Jen's right. He's not even putting into the ether the Chuck Schumer Stop Caffeinating Our Children's Act that would have to be discussed and marked up and put in some kind of hierarchy to see whether or not it would even be brought to the floor. No, he's saying, I am saying the FDA should do something. Anyway, it's me, your old pal Chuck Schumer. Now let me play the spoons.
Yes. So as far as Chuck Schumer is concerned, I think your analysis is dead on balls accurate. I love it. But I also am looking at this. So first of all, he's just asking the FDA to do something. I think that's a pretty good summary of what I've seen. Yes. And I look at this as someone who was a child caffeine addict and like didn't understand it for years. My dad, and I'm not faulting him for this, but he was a executive at Coca-Cola. So from the time I was born, really, I had an unlimited supply of Diet Coke in my house. Just always had it. I loved it. I still love it. And by the time I was starting high school, I was having a Diet Coke the minute I woke up. I would have one on the way to school. I would have one in my zero period class. I would have one at recess, one at lunch, couple after school, and usually one on my way to volleyball practice. So we're talking at least six a day.
Jesus and Christ.
I know, it was a lot. And I just knew that they made me feel better. Like I just loved them, but I didn't put it together that it was the caffeine. So I knew I wasn't allowed to drink coffee, but I didn't realize that like it's the caffeine that's the issue. And yet Diet Coke was full of it. And this was never a discussion in my house. And I don't think my parents ever really put it together either that I was a caffeine addict. I was drinking Diet Coke. There's no sugar in that. And we were worried about sugar. So I was very much addicted. And it wasn't until college where the Diet Cokes were no longer free, where I was like, okay, I need to cut back on this because I'm going to go broke if I'm drinking this much Diet Coke. And the headaches and oh my God, the headaches were awful. And they went on for months. And I, when I was 18 years old, kicked my caffeine habit. It took me, I'm going to say about 3 months to really stop feeling sick. And I was a real bitch for a while too, because it has mood implications as well. Yeah. So, you know, as a child caffeine addict, I feel like the thing that would have been useful for me is if on the can, because I was holding so many of them all the time, if it said on the can, caffeine is a highly addictive drug. In the United States, we do not treat caffeine as a drug. And I think it is a problem. There are actual health effects to caffeine that are quite dangerous. It actually wasn't all that long ago that a bunch of kids were just like slammed a bunch of caffeine. And I think one or two of them died. I can't remember the exact story, but caffeine restricts the blood to your heart and your brain. And so if people are using caffeine, especially pre-workout, there can be really serious health consequences to that because of the effects that it has on your heart. And if you were taking caffeine the way I was definitely disrupting my sleep because I was having it right up until my volleyball practice. A lot of times I didn't start practice till like 7 o'clock at night. And every once in a while I'd have one on the way home too, because I just didn't think about it. And I was tired every single morning. I had zero period. So that meant I started school at 7 o'clock in the morning at a school that was a 20 minute drive away. I was getting up entirely too early. And every day I was dealing with it by using caffeine. So I was definitely having negative sleep consequences. And when you use it that consistently, you're making your heart just work harder every single day. So you can have chronic issues. I've also had, you know, I've talked about this, I don't know about on this show, but I had issues with anxiety and depression, still do. The caffeine did not help them at all. They definitely made it worse. And I feel like our nation's kids and a lot of parents, because like my parents had no idea about any of this. There is a total lack of awareness. And so I don't think that it's a daddy thing, or maybe it's a good daddy thing, to put some warnings on the cans. So like I'm here in Mexico and on all of the cans of soda, it says exceso caffeine or whatever it is in Spanish. But like I can understand enough to say this has excessive caffeine, or it'll say excessive sugar or excessive salt. And it's very obvious. It's a warning label. If the FDA investigation leads to labels like that, telling people that caffeine is a drug, I think that would be so great for our country, because I myself, I'm worried about the damage that I did to my heart for all those years of drinking caffeine. And now I don't drink, every once in a while I'll have some green tea if I need a little pick me up, but I never drink it past noon. I'm very, very careful. And I notice the effects right away. I'll get the headaches pretty quick. It'll be like within the next day or two, especially if I have caffeine a couple of days in a row. And I just feel like we talk about drugs. There's an awareness of alcohol now. There's obviously an awareness of cocaine and fentanyl and all of these, but caffeine is treated as completely normal and fine, and it's not. And so I look at what Chuck Schumer is doing as attention whoring, but also raising awareness. And if this leads to the FDA raising awareness on the cans, I 100% welcome it and think it would be great.
I would have no problem with that if that is the outcome. I see a valid role for the government in using information or transparency to facilitate people to make decisions over their own lives. I've brought up on the show previously, I think Cass Sunstein, who was the head of OIRA back during the Obama administration, did a good thing when he mandated that refrigerators that come out have to post now what the cost of the refrigerator is, but based on the wattage hours, they have to show what it would cost over the course of a year or 3 years or whatever. That way consumers can make that. I'm fine with that. The problem I have is when government paternalism becomes limiting your actions as an adult. So like there was a spat of laws that tried to get passed. I think some of them did, some of them didn't, that happened about 10 years ago, where states and cities would try to limit the size of like a big gulp cup because they thought people were drinking too much sugar. If you want to put
this was Bloomberg in New York City. This is one of the big
Bloomberg actually there. Probably. I agree with everybody. Justin, I think you've actually solved the Chuck Schumer conundrum for me, because there's been several years where I've looked at him and I'm like, why? Like for a while he wanted to regulate how big the legroom was on planes. And it was back when I had no money. And I was like, you're going to have to knock out two or three rows to accomplish this, which means that you will increase the prices like that. That's it. Like if you have fewer rows on a plane, they're going to increase prices to compensate. Like the way things work is not that you knock out three rows and then the head of United goes, damn, I'll make less money, guys. So like, I was looking at that going, surely he understands how supply and demand works. But if it's just attention whoring and he's just kind of the regulatory version of Donald Trump getting clickbait, that makes a lot of sense. So far as the sort of government paternalism thing goes, like I said, my issue is I think adults should be making decisions over their own lives. If the government can help you have more information to make those decisions for yourself, I have no problem with it. If it's going to put labels on things to make things transparent, to give you more information, I think that's fine. I like the things that require calorie distribution when I visit New York. What I have a problem with is if instead of having the calories displayed so that you can make a decision over your meal, Michael Bloomberg were to put in a sugar tax or to limit the amount of dessert you can get or limit the size of your big gulp or something like that. Those are the things where I go, okay, that is now paternalism. That is the government playing the role of a father or a mother. And I don't like that. I don't think that really should be a role there. If it's that, if it's the action-based stuff.
That's fair.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, while your story is certainly very personal to you, Jen, if caffeine is a drug, then you grew up the daughter of a drug dealer if your dad was an executive of Coca-Cola, right?
Actually, so, my dad, because we got free Coca-Colas for Halloween, he would give out cans of Coca-Cola. And so the kids, like, you know, he got a reputation as the Coke man and really didn't like that nickname at all.
I'll tell you what. Yeah, I'm sure the kids went nuts, man. Like kids chugging a can of Coke at 8 o'clock at night, just like hopped up on candy as well. Like that's got to be amazing.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Mr. Clark. I've met him a couple times now. I really, really like him. And this explains a lot, because when we last hung out, he beckoned me over and he's like, hey man, do you want to go do Coke in the bathroom? And I was like, absolutely. So I went into the bathroom with your dad, and he had a trench coat on with like 18 Coca-Cola cans in it.
Yeah.
And he pulled one out, drank one, crushed it on his head, threw it on the ground, and then handed me one. And that's what we did for 3 hours. We just stood in the bathroom drinking Coca-Cola with the Coke band.
Yeah, he's a real badass like that.
Yeah.
As far as labels go, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that there's an element of regulation that has to happen through the FDA, and that would be Prime's argument. Is that number one, if you're going to regulate us beyond where we have already passed your regulation to be on the market to begin with, then I'm sure they would like reciprocity with anybody else that is creating high caffeinated content, because their crime right now is the fact that they're very popular and that they've created a new vertical in consumables, which is extraordinarily valuable and is probably only years away from being purchased by one of the gigantic conglomerates that actually run this business. So for them, I don't know. I'm sure they're probably thrilled, because it just makes their products seem more cool and dangerous, which makes more people want to go buy it, because
it's like I hadn't heard of this until you texted us. And that's, it reminds me of Four Loko, which no one was interested in until it became like the most dangerous thing ever. And then everyone I know was going everywhere to get Four Loko before it was banned. Like, it raises awareness of how cool this dangerous thing is.
Oh my God.
So if anything, it's Schumer's backfiring.
That weekend when the word went out that Four Loko was going to have to change their formula because it was too dangerous, there was a cadre of women in my life at the time that canvassed every gas station in the Western Broward region and just packed into their refrigerator. It was just nothing but Four Loko and kale. That was it. Like they were just, just packed it out. Anyway.
And like special occasions for the following year, someone would open the fridge and be like, I have 3 Four Lokos. Oh my God. Like it was very exciting.
I think for the record, it should not shock anybody that they were all pregnant within 5 years, but that was, that was definitely a moment in time for which I will treasure forever. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Slicker than yellow spandex in July, bub. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com is where you write into the show. Supreme Court Blender writes, I'm a member of a new sect of Christianity known as the Church of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Latter-day Saints. I fundamentally believe that no souls can enter heaven until the American people have melted into one race. I understand that this will take centuries, but I want to aid this goal. I will not recognize the sanctity of same-race marriage, and for this reason, our church will not perform them. Here's the problem, though. I run a bakery, a successful bakery. I get at least 100 requests for wedding cakes per day, but I can only spit them out maybe a dozen or so at a time. Here's the thing. I don't discriminate based on race, but I do use it as sort of a tiebreaker, preferring to make cakes for more obscure unions like Inuits marrying Vietnamese, for example. I certainly haven't accepted any requests to make any white or black cakes lately because too many multiracial applications come in each day. Is it permissible or am I discriminating based on a protected class and can be sued, Andrew Heat?
Yes, you could be sued. Points on the colorful question there. I had to read it 2 times to understand what was going on. It's complicated but delightful. I enjoyed the mental exercise. If anybody wants to learn about this, I did a Judge Week about this time last year on the political orphanage. If you can find those episodes. I think the episode is entitled Can I Do Peyote If It's Religious? Or something to that effect. The court has a lot of precedent that deal with whether or not you can exempt yourself from something because you claim religious exemption to it. Going right back to the founding of our country, there were Quakers in 1776 that were pacifists who did not want to pay taxes because that was going to go to the war effort. After basically the government from the beginning went, can somebody not pay taxes if they feel that it's against their religion? This isn't going to surprise you, but the answer is no. The government decided that you have to pay taxes. This has evolved over the last 100 years to where if you are going to try to gain immunity from a law, you can't just say it's religious. I don't like it because of my religion. You have to prove to the standards of the court that it actually is a religion that you practice and believe, that it is a religion, that there's a group of people that follow it, that you didn't just make it up, and that the religious principle that is being detracted by the law is actually fundamental to your religion and would cause tangible harm or not, would cause large harm to your religious proclivities. So theoretically, if I went into the House of Representatives and I started singing Catholic hymns very loudly and they went, sir, you can't do that. You're disrupting business. I couldn't say, but it's my religion. I can sing hymns loudly if I want, because if it went to court, they could go, all right, do you have to sing hymns right then in the Capitol? Do you think you go to hell if you don't sing hymns? And I'd go, no, I could theoretically do it somewhere else. Or I could, they go, okay, then it's not causing harm. So anyway, colorful example, but I do not think you could wage a good defense of that example under court precedent. You would not be qualified for Establishment Clause immunity.
But I think the point that the writer is trying to make is that the Supreme Court kind of did legalize that by allowing the website creator to not make a website for a same-sex couple. And that baker who didn't want to make the cake for the same-sex couple, like, this is the case where you and I, well, no, like, Justin is married to a white lady. I'm married to a white man. And so this is turning the discrimination on its head. Instead of discriminating against a same-sex couple, this example is discriminating against us. Does it feel different when it's against us? And I think one of the concerns that this interesting analogy brings up is it's discrimination either way, you know, and the Supreme Court is expanding that being allowed. So it's like you're talking about maybe what the cases would have said or maybe should have said, but the Supreme Court is turning that on its head and making this all a gray area. So I like this example because it makes people like us kind of feel that discrimination that is now kind of legalized by the Supreme Court.
Well, but also they are taking the Harvard case, which is the other side of this.
Yeah, it's combining the affirmative action case with the gay cake one or the gay webpage one.
So nobody, if there is a same race couple that is coming to this fantasy cake maker, they are never being denied. They are just being told, I'm extraordinarily busy and I use these things as a tiebreaker. So that would be the affirmative action side of Harvard and the University of North Carolina. They were never saying that any white person or Asian person is denied based on race. They are saying that because they have so many, the tiebreaker is where what is shaping this thing. So I thought it was a good email.
Yeah, me too.
A voice of tax reason says, while you can file your taxes late without a penalty, if and only if you are getting a refund, you forfeit any refund you are entitled to after 3 years of that return being due. On the other hand, if you owe money, the IRS will go back 10 years to collect, and there is no limit if they find any kind of intentional tax fraud. So there we go.
That is super... Yeah. Super helpful to know, truly, because last year the IRS said they sent me a letter, we're giving you a refund. And then I never got the check. And then I went to the website and they're like, well, the check wasn't cashed. It's there now. And then I asked my accountant, can we just add that to this year's taxes? No, we can't do that. So thank you. Cause now I'm just going to be a fucking entire day of my life to get this like $500 the IRS owes me. But all the same, glad to know. Cause if I don't do it in the next year, it'll go away.
I've actually found the IRS customer service to be more responsive than in the past. Like if you just call, and they're so nice. I actually don't think it'll take you all that long, but I think the moral of the story is just do your damn taxes. Like they're not that hard. Just do them.
I mean, it says you, jeez.
I know my dad does them. I'm a total princess. I don't do my own taxes.
I know. Jesus. He does your taxes. He's throwing you cans of Coke like Stone Cold Steve Austin. This is like a very charmed life you lead, Jen.
But most people just have like their W whatever from their bosses, put it in TurboTax, like, you know, get them done.
Not me, man. I got it.
I know.
I have a nightmare with my taxes. I can't even say it. Riot Girl writes, listening to Jen's protest story turned riot tells me that she is indeed the brave liberal that all others think they are. It is true bravery to speak up against the group, especially when they start engaging in violence.
Thank you. I'll take that for the one time I actually did it. My actual solution was to become a coward and never go back again. But thank you for saying that.
Gay.com writes, the Yankee Doodle Panther is wrong and Jen is correct on legal issues around the 303 creative decision. According to the Equal Rights Act, any business that provides a service needs to provide that service to everyone, especially those of a protected class. And gay people are a protected class. 303 Creative is providing a service, not speech. And the worst part about the decision is that there is no limiting factor as set by it. So the Supreme Court just allowed a business to be able to discriminate against any person for religious reasons. And I recommend reading Andrew Seidel, a constitutional lawyer, on the topic.
So two points to that. I think the part of your email you bring up about there not being a limiting factor is an interesting one that's worth exploring. I will say for folks that are gay listening to the program, just so you get a little bit less worried, the court was very explicit about making a distinction between speech versus public accommodation. And public accommodation is not in doubt. So lunch counters, car rentals, things that are just a widget coming on a factory line are still protected by this. Although it is interesting to think where that could potentially go. I will take a little bit of umbrage in that I was explaining the Supreme Court's decision. You didn't actually tackle my reasoning. You tackled the court's decision, which is fine, but I'm not a member of the Supreme Court. I would take a different variation on this. One which, to my knowledge, no legal scholar is advocating, so it's probably bunk. The fact that no attorneys are advocating what I'm about to say indicates that it probably doesn't hold merit in a court of law. But from where I'm at, if you're going to abrogate somebody's freedom of speech or freedom of association, which is not really a strong thing in constitutional law, but just kind of philosophically, somebody's freedom of association, if you're going to abrogate that, you need to pass strict scrutiny. So if an ambulance driver is called out to go to a gay wedding and he doesn't want to go because it's a gay wedding, that passes strict scrutiny. The state has a very legitimate interest in compelling that person to provide medical aid to somebody who needs it, regardless of their personal beliefs. And I'm in favor of that, as I think most people are. Where I don't think that passes strict scrutiny, in my reasoning, is where the damage being done is essentially emotional for a activity of meaning or symbolism. If it's something life and limb or even something involving livelihood, I think that passes strict scrutiny. But with things that are ephemeral, like a wedding cake, which you do not legally have to have, which are ornamental, and the damage is one of not feeling included, I don't think that passes strict scrutiny. And the reason I say that is that in a pluralistic society, people get to have reprobate opinions if it doesn't directly cause harm to somebody else. I'm very pro-gay. I'm very pro-gay marriage, but I don't think that role of society. I'll get married to a man one of these days, but I don't want society to be able to say, we are going to effectively ban unpopular opinions, which I think is the outcome for people that want to crack down on the gay cake maker guy, Michael, what's his name, want to crack down on the webpage person. For the folks that are wanting to do that, I agree with your bearings in regards to homosexuality. We're on the same page. Where we defer is that I am not authoritarian about it. I'm much more reluctant to force other people to come to our opinion. And I reserve that for when it is something that is life and limb or livelihood, but not things which are emotional.
You know, apropos of nothing to these particular cases, something that I would love, and if people have you know, if there's a book been written on this or a feature or something, the concept of the industrial complex where people push cases that they know they want precedent on, because like I do think that there is something very, very interesting about the creation of this website case, where it doesn't appear that there was actually a conflict. It appears that a conflict
was preemptive,
was you know, staged, right? But there is there just a cabal of people that sit around and are like, all right, what's this season's cases that we want to push based on new law that came in or old law that we want to continue to push on? Because you've seen throughout history that this is a thing that's done, and it was done with civil rights. It's been done through some of these things that we just saw. But even the student, the affirmative action thing, there's been a lot of reporting that's gone into how those lawsuits came together. And it was an activist, an anti-affirmative action activist, who was tapping in to anger in the Asian American community. Now that doesn't mean that there wasn't already anger in the community for being discriminated against, but it does mean that somebody woke up every day and said, I want to push this. And my hope is that it creates a successive chain of legal decisions that eventually gets to the Supreme Court and changes the world. I don't know. I find that fascinating. If anybody knows anything about that, please email into the show. Unga Bunga writes, Heaton's comments about the student debt crisis have temporarily reassured me that not all libertarians are primitive barbarians.
Thank you very much. On the advice of my counsel, Jen Briney, I only purport to be an independent, but I nonetheless accept your praise in the spirit it was given, and thank you.
Fun Boat Trip writes, once upon a time, I was a part of a small U.S. aid mission dropping off supplies to various Central American countries via ship. I am not in the military. My shipmates and I found a pizza joint in Costa Rica that offered extra large pies and a gallon of Pepsi for $6. After sitting down, the owner came out so excited to have Americans back. He mistook our short haircuts and sunglasses for the CIA. I explained in broken Spanish that we were just dropping off medical supplies and building equipment, and he winked and nodded. He explained while showing shrapnel scars that he was a big deal in the Contras in Nicaragua. He described working for the CIA as a young man as the best time of his life, and that if he were to come back, he'd be more than happy to help the CIA again. I politely asked why he wasn't in Nicaragua, and he explained that he couldn't go back because of war crime charges and other government nonsense. What a fun
those war wow. crimes. Those war crimes.
Just whatever. Wow. All right. So things that I will always put in the mailbag. wild stories like that that are actually good, and any kind of sports trivia for Heaton. Those are automatic ads. Actually, it's Frankenstein's student loan debt, not Frankenstein, writes, I get that we don't want to cancel all of this student debt willy-nilly and overburden the taxpayer. I am a taxpayer after all. However, I don't think it's fair that we essentially created this financial incentive for universities to hike tuition at an unprecedented rate because they know that the tuition will be provided, especially with how interest rates have skyrocketed. My promissory note requires me to sign 10% interest this past spring. I emailed the Department of Education to consider lowering the interest rate before signing, but they refused. How is it fair to hike interest rates to 10% and subjugate students indefinitely just because we wanted a chance at an education? It really isn't, and it's unconscionable and unjustly enriching banks and universities. I will take them to the Supreme Court if I have to, and I would love to hear your arguments and perspective on the issue, so I'm fully prepared to debate the justices. Thank you.
It's not fair.
It's not fair. I think it gets worse than that. The reason that you can't discharge student loans through bankruptcy, and I'm going to be off on my dates here, but in the 90s, it was the 80s or the 90s. There was a push to try to make student loans more readily available to people who had not completed high school. The idea being people that didn't graduate high school are having a tough time. We're going to try and make it even easier for them to go to college. And then a couple of years later, there was this big panic. There was an article in the New York Times about these people are all going to drop out and then declare bankruptcy because they were already ill-equipped to graduate high school. Why would we think they're going to graduate college? So they're going to go there for a couple of years, drop out, and then the taxpayers will be on the bill for the money. And so what did Congress do? Congress went, don't worry, we will make it illegal for them to discharge their money through debt. So Congress purposefully looked for people that didn't graduate high school, went, hey, you should go to college. Would you like a loan? And then went, by the way, you can never get rid of this loan, ever. You have to pay it back and all those things. It's a really predatory system. And what I wish that we would do is focus on how to reform that system. I think a lot of the time it ends up being a political football between I was told I need a college education to get ahead in life and get a decent job. I did what you told me, and now I'm saddled with this horrible debt versus the other side, which is where emotionally I come from, which is, hey, I could have gone to a better school than the one I went to, but I made the fiscally prudent decision, went to a mid-level state school as opposed to a fancy school. Why am I being penalized for having made that decision? I think we need to get past that, and we need to figure out how to just reform the system as a whole to be better for everybody.
Agreed. And reforming the system is the solution here, not canceling debt for a select group of people that just are lucky enough to be here now because there's still loans being issued. This whole cancel student debt movement is, I think it's a giant waste of time, honestly. As good as I think it would be for the people that would benefit, you're just dancing around the edges of the issue. I wish that this much energy was going towards reforming the system as opposed to canceling debt, because even if you get it accomplished, you know, there's moments in time for this, right? Like, so 2010 was our moment in time for reforming the healthcare system, and we did a shit job of it. This seems to be the moment in time on student loans. And if you accomplish this cancellation of student debt, is it going to be another decade before we bring this up? And we're fighting the wrong battle. So, I feel for everyone who's writing in about their student loans. You're right that it's unfair. And I wish Congress would do something about it, but this Congress isn't going to. This Congress is the worst Congress ever. So we need to do a better job electing people who care about this issue in order to have any hope.
Well, also nobody's incentivized to do it via election, because the reason why you're more likely to get elected by saying I'll cancel student debt than I'll reform the system. And that's what the Democrats have run on, especially progressives have run on for the last decade or so. And so what they want, at least the most politically efficacious solution from the progressive point of view, is to cancel a gigantic amount of student debt and then every 5 years cancel more student debt. That's a political football that they want. And I think we're going to see a rapidly changing meta in politics over the next few years, because a lot of very, very, very big political footballs that have existed for a long time are at the very least changing, if not possibly somewhat getting resolved or coming to positions where they're not going to be as heightened, abortion being at the top of the list there. that regardless of where this falls, it will not be this superposition of Roe versus Wade, which is very fragile, but very important. And so therefore every election is the biggest election because it might affect this thing that is suspended in air. Especially on the left, the idea of student debt, because they have more college graduates that are a part of their voting bloc and coalition, progressives have done very, very well going out and saying, I will cancel student debt. And I think that that's going to be the solution.
But on the other hand, the corporate Democrats are doing very, very well by kissing banker ass and getting all kinds of money from the American Bankers Association and dark money. And So they don't want to do anything about interest rates because that is their true constituency. So you have two factions in the Democratic Party, and the money faction is definitely winning out right now.
Well, I think to our point, though, we're not talking about the actual solution. either the progressives or the more centrist or corporate Democrats are talking about, or even the Republicans are talking about what the problem is. The problem is the fact that the cost of tuition is going up, the efficacy of the degrees is going down, and the interest rates are out of control, and you can't declare bankruptcy on them. So it's like we have created this mousetrap where we are pushing kids into it, that the bargain is worse and worse and worse and worse going forward, to the point where now we are seeing, like I said last week, a material, everything that you said you needed to go to college for, you're going to have more earning potential. You're going to be able to therefore earn more money that allows you to buy a house, that allows you to have a more financially stable marriage, that would allow you to have kids, that would allow you to do all these things. All of this is being pushed back. All of this is being materially harmed by the amount of student debt that people are taking out and the onerous interest that is put upon them. So we have absolutely, through all of our best efforts, reversed all of the trends that we wanted to create by way of incentivizing going to college. And so, yes, until we address that, until we address those problems, I think that it is further complicated by the fact that the U.S. Department of Education owns most of this debt, that the private bank lending is at an extraordinarily low level. Then, you know, that to me is the bailout I want. The bailout I want is, hey, let everybody, if they want to, declare bankruptcy on this and see how good of a bargain you've made.
Yeah, I like that.
That would be a phenomenal first step, is just, declare bankruptcy, or have the option to declare bankruptcy, just like you would if you were a company or anything else. There are a lot of people wouldn't want to do that. I know people personally that would absolutely do that. It would make their lives a lot better.
But yeah. I do think that if we were to do something like that, we have to allow the people that have paid back their loans to not have to declare bankruptcy. Because if you took out, let's say, a $100,000 loan, and now you're on the hook for $200,000 because of the interest, like I read about someone who has paid back multiple loans and owes far more than she ever did. Like, I just don't think that's fair to have to pay these loans back multiple times over. I think if you've paid back the original loan, and maybe we can set an interest rate of, like, I don't know, 3%, whatever fucking inflation is or whatever. But if you've paid that back, you're done. And then the people that haven't paid that back, they can have the option for bankruptcy. But I don't think that people should have to pay back loans that are completely unfair and unreasonable. I think that has to be a part of it.
I mean, I don't know. We'll debate this in our fantasy Congress that we will put together.
What are we even talking about?
Yeah. We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is the inimitable Will Saddleberg. Heaton, what do you got on the orphanage this week, huh?
Did you know that writers in Hollywood are striking?
Yeah, good God. Oh, yeah. No, it's the most important thing on the planet. And salute to all the writers. I know a lot more WGA people than I know heads of studios. So I am on your side. Solidarity forever. Wake me up when you settle it. I don't need the fucking daily back and forth about it.
Well, I'm not super interested in the back and forth and the daily stuff and what's going to be in the contract. But what I am really interested in is how writer strikes actually affect the industry long term. So for example, the reason that we have reality television, where it got its instigation from, was a writer's strike, because television shows got to crank stuff out. They can't just run reruns all the time. So when there was a writer's strike, I think it wasn't the 08, maybe it was the 08,
the 08, 08 one, the 08, yeah. The 08 one is the one that is looked at as the supercharging of reality television.
So I'm really interested in that. I'm interested in the economics of crappy creative decisions. So I brought on a friend of mine that I know in LA that has worked for Oliver Stone, and he's worked on the creative side, and then he got into finance, so he's worked on the financial side. And I have a conversation with him about how this is going to affect things. And he has an interesting thesis about how AI is going to shake out due to all this.
Cool. Jen, what is on the roadmap for The Dish?
I've actually been dreading this question. Nothing. I needed another week off on Sunday, the night before I was going to start working on Congressional Dish again. I was so anxious and upset, and I just couldn't shake it. And so, you know, my husband is wonderful, and he pulled out of me like what the problem was. And I'm not ready to spend time watching Congress right now. Also, my mom's here in Mexico City, so it's like I'd rather spend time with my mom while she's here instead of trying to work at the same time. But this Congress is so bad. I still get the emails every day giving me updates, and it's so awful that I'm just having trouble making this my job right now.
When you say depressing, awful, like they are certainly combative. Is it the fact that they are just not doing anything?
No, it's that I can see my crystal ball, like what's coming in the government funding and the NDAA, and to please these psychos in the Freedom Caucus, like real damage is going to get done. So like one of the proposals, they're doing the transportation funding bill right now. They want to cut funding for Amtrak in the Northeast corridor by 94%. 94%. Like their proposals are so extreme. And so to even meet them in the middle and to get their votes, bad things are going to happen. These people are wrecking balls. And, you know, you look at Tommy Tuberville, he's now up to like 200 people nominations for the military that he's holding up because he doesn't want women in the military to be able to travel to get abortions. Like that is so extreme. And I get so upset about everything that I read right now when it comes to Congress that I can't for another week. I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm crying. This is what I'm talking about. My anxiety about this job is. And I just know it's going to get worse. So like right now, nothing is happening. So I don't have much to talk about, which is hard to make a show. Although the episode that I'm working on is about Adam Schiff, who's a disgusting creature. The Democrats are calling him a hero. And yet the censure that was done by the Democrats, like everywhere, the Republicans, it's stupid. So it's like everyone's behaving badly now and there's not much going on. But when my busy season comes, I'm just going to be upset all the time. Sorry.
No, I mean, look, it shows that there's a real passion that you put into your work. And I don't think that you should be ever sad about that or ever apologize for that. That's what people pay for.
It's just, I'm tired of seeing all bad news. I'm tired of being the deliverer of all bad news. And all we have had coming out of this Congress is bad news and just behavior worse than I've ever seen. You know, we have Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert screaming at each other on the House floor. And so the Freedom Caucus kicks out Marjorie Taylor Greene. You know you're in trouble when she is the sane one in a fight. And you just know that like Kevin McCarthy is not going to do what John Boehner did the last time it was this psycho, where he made a deal on government funding with the Democrats. And the damage was minimal. There was some, but it wasn't that bad. Kevin McCarthy's not that guy. He just keeps bending to the crazies. And it's like it's so partisan and so crazy at this point that I'm afraid of reading what's in these bills this year. It's, I don't know. Like I said, I'm not ready. I'm not ready to go back into this.
Understood.
So nothing for Congressional Dish until I'm less mental.
Well, geez.
This is embarrassing.
I really wish I would have known that was your thing, because I can't follow it with a plucky little plug for PX30 now.
Sorry, I wasn't meaning to cry on air, I swear.
No, yeah. Anyway, I also do a thing. That's it for us today. Please, we love you guys. Until next time, we're not wrong.
This is a very embarrassing ending.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.